Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Minnesota Bound Podcast, the stories behind the stories. I'm Laura Sherry, your host for today. And joining the Minnesota Bound Podcast is Tony Jones, the author of a new book called The God of Wild Places, Rediscovering the Divine in the Untamed Outdoors. Tony, welcome to the Minnesota Bound Podcast.
Thanks, Laura. Long time listener, first time caller. Thrilled to be on with you.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm so excited to have you on. I have a feeling you're going to become a regular on the Minnesota Bound Podcast after reading your book. You have so much to share about discovering life in the outdoors, but what prompted you to write a book about rediscovering the meaning of life through nature and the outdoors?
Let's see. My entire life falling apart, I guess, is what prompted it. Laura, I was a pastor, as you know from the book, and
yes,
taught in seminary, and that my life was really revolved around being what we sometimes jokingly refer to in the industry as being a professional Christian, you know, sure. Like getting paid to be a preacher and a theologian and stuff like that. And I'd written a lot of books in that genre. But then I went through a rough decade, and I lost pretty much that. My whole career went down the tubes due to just personal stuff, divorce, custody, and the internet being real involved in my life. And so because I'm a writer, I think it, ultimately, you know, I that's how I process a lot of what I'm thinking and going through. So I've been just kind of writing away at this book for a long time. It took a long time to get it right. But it really helped me process like the pain that I went through, and then figuring out, yeah, like you already mentioned, how the outdoors and my outdoors activities really were the things that replaced organized religion in my life and really gave me meaning and healing from the pain.
It certainly will do that. That's for sure. It's a wonderful healing place. What did you have, you know, a thought in mind when you were writing? Because some of the chapters in your book really speak to me and some of my personal beliefs on how the outdoors can really set you up for success in life in general. And it's not like there's a manual when you go out there. It teaches you on its own. Did you have, you know, when you're putting your chapters together, some of which are risk, failure, death, companion, and more, did you have a thought in mind on how you wanted to leave an imprint on people that read your book? Or how did you come up with like the chapters, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't think I've done a lot of podcasts promoting this book in the last 2 weeks and no one's really asked me that. So I appreciate you asking me. It didn't start as the book that you've read. It was much more of, it was more of like a straight ahead memoir when I started it, like this happened, then this happened, then this happened, you know, kind of like, in journalism, they call it a TikTok kind of story where you sit down to write and you just tell the chronology of events in the way that they happened. And that, it didn't really work. It just wasn't really working as a book. And like I said, I wrote this book over, it took me over 10 years to write my shortest book ever. So what I started to do was I realized, and this helped, I had a couple friends read it, and I got a new literary agent. He really helped me on this. I started to think of it thematically, you know, like taking the stories of my life and kind of putting them in different categories or different silos, if you will, you know. So, oh, these stories are really about risk in the wilderness, and these stories are about death, and these stories are about my dogs and how they've become my companions in my loneliest times. And So then it became more thematic, and it wasn't like so much a straight ahead memoir. And I had these categories, which for me, actually, it helped me get my mind around the content a lot better. Because then as I was kind of working it through, I'm like, yeah, this story doesn't really work in this chapter. And why am I trying to force a story into a chapter where it doesn't fit? So I'm just going to cut it out and like put it in what writers call the slush pile and let it kind of hang out there. And if I come back to it and I need it elsewhere, I can use it elsewhere. So that was that's kind of how I organized it. And then even those chapters that you already mentioned, then what I realized also is that I had to, the book went from less intense to more intense. So yeah, the second to last chapter is called Death, in which I talk about, you know, the first time I shot a deer. I'm an adult. I started hunting as an adult. And so that all this is pretty new to me. And I kind of write in parallel about killing a deer for the first time and the emotions that provoked in me. And then also watching my dad die and actually having a hand in, you know, at a point my brothers and I told the doctors at the hospital not to take any further action to try to save my dad. So I didn't kill him like I kill a deer, but as I point out in the chapter, there's some similarities. You know, I had some agency in the death of my father, just like I have a lot of agency in the death of a deer that I shoot with a rifle. So that's the most intense chapter, you know, and it's toward the end. And so then I structured it kind of like a little more lighthearted to a little more intense as you go through the book.
I noticed that. And, you know, I think the chapter about death is a very important chapter because, in my personal opinion, I think we've had so many conveniences in life, including when we go to the grocery store. We don't have to face death when we put chicken that's wrapped in saran wrap into our cart. And, you know, one of the lines in the book that I really spoke to me is when you wrote, "What cripples us in life is not the inevitability of death, but the fear of it." And yeah, when you step into the outdoors and you realize that there is death every day out there, and it is life or death and survival in nature. It doesn't matter if you're an insect or you're a deer being chased by a wolf. And we are a part of that cycle. And when you are forced to, all of us will be forced to face death at some point. But when you get out into nature and you can expose yourself to that and learn how to deal with the emotions and understand the circle of life, I feel that there is some sort of resiliency that happens for all of us when we do that. And we also have more of a greater importance of the food that's on our table. We understand.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I absolutely agree with both of those, and I'll take them both in turn. First, about the death, I think you're exactly right. And I make a point in the chapter on death that, you know, we've really sequestered death. We've pushed it away so that we don't have to confront it as humans. And it's funny how much that's changed us so rapidly, because of course our ancestors, Laura, were totally acquainted with death. Not only with, you know, like, hey, go out back and chop the head off a chicken and bring it in here for dinner, but also like grandma's dying in the bed upstairs. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just how we did it as a species. And of course, so for thousands, tens of thousands of years, all of our ancestors were really acquainted with death. And now we're not. You know, we just don't see it. We don't even have open casket. I can tell you as a pastor, we don't even really have open casket funerals anymore. Most people, you know, mm-hmm. like wakes or revuels. A lot of times now, families want to have a thing called a celebration of life, where there's no body, not even an urn with ashes in it, in the church for the service. the absence of the body, of the dead body, is really, I don't know of any other culture in human history that's done that. And we've suddenly done that. And, you know, there's this, there's just wisdom in like almost every spiritual tradition. Going back, let's even talk about like the ancient Greek and Roman Stoic philosophers who talked often about keeping your death before you at all times. Because if you keep your death before you, if you remember your own mortality, you will, you'll live a better life. You know, you'll just like, I mean, it can be a bit pithy, like to say, oh, you treat every day like it's your last. What would you do today if it were your last day? Would you like, would you really fight with your spouse? You know, would you really sit around watching TV or stare at your phone all day? Or would you go do something worthwhile and valuable? And there's that for sure. But there's also like a deeper existential thing going on, that if you keep your own mortality front and center at all times, and remember that your time here is finite, it will cause you to live more deeply, to think more deeply, love more deeply. And as I say in the book, nothing has brought me more in touch with death than hunting.
Oh, yes.
And I, like I told you, I didn't grow up hunting. So that was a big part of it. And then to the second point, and I think you and I, you know, I've watched so many of your segments on wild game cooking. And I, again, that's something as an adult onset hunter, I've only been doing for the last 10 years, but I'm just like fanatical about it, fanatical about wild game cooking. And my kids ate it and my spouse eats it happily all the time. And our goal, it, now that we're empty nesters, Courtney and I have a goal of eating only wild game, you know, and I really felt disconnected from the food I was eating. Like you say, that it's so easy to go grocery shopping and grab, you know, a chicken breast wrapped in plastic that from a chicken that was alive and that was butchered by somebody somewhere. And we've become so, again, disassociated from that, just like we have from death, that from like where our food comes from. And that was just something that in my own like life crisis and crisis of faith, I really wanted to fix. I really wanted to be in touch with the food I was eating and what was sustaining me. So those two things, yeah, I think they're, and those two chapters, as you know, are right next to each other, meat and death, because they're so tied together.
Absolutely.
I want to thank our good friends at Kinetico. You know, spring is very close, if not already here. You know, the Shirk family, we are back out fishing and playing soccer outdoors, and the Shirk boys still never leave home without filling their water bottles. Really, it's the Kinetico water. We have Kinetico whole home water systems both at home and at the cabin. We also installed Kinetico's K5 drinking water system. And let me tell you, this stuff makes a big difference. The Kinetico installations were both quick and easy. No more stinky, foul well water. We now have Kinetico soft water and also Kinetico's K5 drinking water. No more bottled water, just great drinking water right out of the K5 tap. Our laundry, it no longer smells funny, and the Kinetico water cleaned up the showers and our dishes. The world's most efficient, worry-free water system. Visit Kinetico.com to find a dealer near you and join the Kinetico family. Also, we'd like to thank our newest sponsor, Minnesota Masonic Charities.
When people think of the Freemasons, they often think of secret handshakes and unusual hats, and of course, the pancake breakfast. Minnesota Masonic Charities would prefer that you think about the work that they do right here in our community. Places like the Masonic Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota or the Masonic Children's Hospital and the Masonic Home in Bloomington. They are just a few examples of the important work that the Freemasons support here in Minnesota. As part of the largest fraternal organization in the world, Masons have consistently answered the call when it comes to charitable needs. I am happy that Minnesota Masonic Charities has chosen Minnesota Bound and this podcast as a place to help spread the word. We look forward to learning so much more about their many programs here in the weeks to come.
Hey there, Bill Shirk, the man about the woods. Propane, it's clean, efficient fuel produced right here in the United States. Schedule your propane service with a friend. Lakes Gas, a family-owned provider serving the upper Midwest for more than 60 years. 54 convenient locations in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Now with offices in North Dakota and South Dakota, too. Lakes Gas employees live in the communities they serve, so you can expect personalized service from professionals. Oh, and the Lakes Gas offers competitive pricing without all the extras that tend to drive up fuel prices. Safe, dependable service. Lakes Gas, the right choice for your home, business, or farm. Visit lakesgas.com and join the family.
There's also the disassociation with where your food comes from, and even I feel it scales it all the way down to fruits and vegetables. And even if you are a processed food eater, all of those things still require death of an animal to be produced. And many people think that if they choose that direction of food, that they don't have any accountability or association with death, which I think is fascinating to me. Because billions of animals, from field mice to insects, wetlands, all sorts of things are destroyed, of course, by monocrop agriculture. And we need agriculture to feed the people on our planet. So I'm not saying that's not necessary. But when you disassociate yourself with having any accountability for death, it's almost like you're trying to take yourself out of the environmental nature cycle of how we all survive. And I think that's where in hunting is so important, is allowing yourself to deal with the death and understand that that is just a part of life. And in the hunting community, and I'm happy to see so many more people being acceptance of hunting for a food source, because they have a greater understanding that that animal had a free range life. They're organic. They were roaming anywhere they wanted to roam for a long time before, and how many meals you can make out of one animal versus how many billions of animals are being killed from, you know, grains and things that we are putting in cereals and such. But that, and sportsmen, I think people are also understanding when they're out there hunting, it's not like you're cheering up and down when you take an animal's life. When I shot my first deer, you're kind of like, it's very still, it's quiet, and you can smell death too. It's there's a lot of sensory things happening at that moment. And again, there's something spiritual that happens, and there's something primal and ancestral that comes out of you when you are also hunting that I think is really divine in that moment, seconds before you are going to take an animal's life.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree with you. First of all, on the fallacy that vegetarians and vegans are not implicated in the death of animals, because of course they are. It's funny, Laura, last week I flew to Los Angeles to debate a Christian vegan who tries.
Interesting.
He made this movie where he's trying to argue that Jesus was a vegan and therefore we should all be vegans, which is ludicrous, really? A ludicrous argument. But, you know, his main point is like, oh, we shouldn't hurt animals. We shouldn't hurt animals. And I'm like, dude, why don't you come walk with me through a cornfield? And I, like you, I have a huge amount of respect for farmers.
Same.
But I drive out to South Dakota 6 times a year to pheasant hunt. And I see, if fields aren't already tiled, they've got pipes laying in the field ready to be put in to tile. And I know there go the wetlands, you know, and with what goes away with the wetlands, all the little critters, all the insects, you know, it is something that is confronting us that we're going to have to deal with. And, and my kids do this too. My boys, who are, you know, ravenous meat eaters, as a lot of young men tend to be, who are power lifters and that kind of thing. They'll send me these, you know, Instagram memes of like, you know, some almond farmer or avocado farmer in California holding up a bunch of critters that he's killed, you know, to so that his avocados can grow. And so the point is, yes, we do this as human beings. And I like to think that as a hunter, when I'm implicated in the death of another animal, that I'm much more aware of it, that I'm more conscious about doing it. And that I'm not, that that animal is not going to waste, but it's feeding me and my family. And then, you know, like we've already talked about, I mean, I'm going to die. I'm going to go into the ground. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to become hummus and the next tree is going to grow out of me.
Yeah.
And so I totally agree with you. And I also agree with you on this, because the guy, like when I was debating this vegan, he's like, doesn't it break your heart when you kill a deer? And I said, yes,
it does.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. And I don't ever want it not to, you know, and it is a very intense experience that puts us in touch with mortality. And I don't want to become callous to that experience or immune to that experience. And it's harder, those of us like, and I know you are too on this, like who are multi-species hunters, like when you hunt birds, it's different. It's different when you're shooting multiple pheasants in a day or multiple grouse in a day. And then I think it takes, frankly, for me as a hunter, it takes even more conscientiousness for me at the end of a day. I'm not going to probably stop every time I shoot a pheasant and kind of like thank the pheasant. It's not as big of an animal. It's not a mammal. I don't have the same connection to it that I do when I shoot a deer. And I only shoot one or two deer a year, and I shoot, I don't know, 40 or 50 pheasants a year. Mm-hmm. So, but at the end of the day, you know, I had a friend recently. She was joking with me about the picture, you know, we all take, the tailgate of death, she calls it, when we load up all of our pheasants on the tailgate of the pickup truck with the dogs and take a picture. And even that, you know, I think there's some of us in the hunting community who are thinking, how can we be more conscientious about even what we post on social media about the animals that we're hunting and show more respect to the animal than maybe we have in the past. So like with pheasants, as I was saying, I have to make a point at the end of the day, look at these pheasants, like these pheasants gave their lives for me to eat in the same way that the deer that I shot and I'm very thankful for gave its life. So it's different with different species, but nevertheless, I'm trying to like inculcate in myself a practice of conscientiousness when I'm hunting, and I never want to become, like I said, callous or immune to the life that gave itself for my life.
Yes, totally agree. And I do feel that hunters are becoming a little bit more conscious of, again, the tailgate of death photo. Even my dad said a long time ago, he's like, it really isn't necessary to, I always feel like take what you need and leave the rest is kind of my personal philosophy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not about the numbers. It's about, for me, more importantly, A, if it's a conservation effort, B, it's for food, and just to be mindful of that. And also how we place, I find it fascinating on how our brains work, how it's the size of an animal that can sometimes dictate our compassion for it.
Yeah.
And that goes for everybody across the board. If you're a vegetarian, vegan, a hunter, not hunter, that, you know, like field mice, for instance, billions and billions of field mice are killed from farming. And right. Yet if someone, that's not a problem, but if someone is harvesting a moose, then that is, from a human perspective, we put so much more feeling towards that. And I find that more of as an observation moment of that's just kind of fascinating to me on why we put more value based on the size of an animal. But what I think too, what you had said is that you don't ever want to become callous to the idea of hunting or taking an animal's life. And I think that mindfulness that you get from facing death out in the field also transfers into mindfulness of how we interact with each other too, and having compassion for others and all of those things. That can translate back to, again, just being more of a even-minded, mindful person, and kind of pulling a lens back at things when you are dealing with stuff just in everyday life, and being able to look at kind of a greater perspective of stuff to be more conscious and mindful overall.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, in the book, I refer to this, what you're talking about, as the eyelash rule. Like we tend to, when animals that have eyelashes, like I'll ask people, I can't believe you hunt. I could never kill a deer. Well, I'll say, do you fish? Oh yeah. Do you kill the fish, or catch and release? But sometimes you see that fish floating belly up 5 minutes later, right? After it swallowed the hook or whatever. Or they eat fish. Oh yeah, I don't have any problem eating fish. I'm like, why? I don't know. They'll say, there's just something about a deer. I'm like, is it the big brown glassy eyes with the eyelashes? Yeah, that's probably it. And I'm like, do you think a wolf cares about the eyelashes on a deer? Like, we're an apex predator. Let's strip away everything out. Let's strip away our tendency to anthropomorphize other animals and make Bambi movies or whatever. I mean,
I know
we make Finding Nemo. Yeah, we make Finding Nemo too. Like, we also anthropomorphize fish. I mean,
that's true.
We do it with all sorts of species, but let's just like strip away all the spirituality and all the enlightenment values and thought, and just be like, we're an apex predator. We are the top of the food chain, and we're the, you know, most invasive species ever to inhabit this planet, because we've been very successful at hunting and more recently at agriculture. But before there was ag, you know, before any of our ancestors were domesticating animals and were crop farming, they were hunters and foragers, and they were extremely successful at it. It seems like they were probably more successful at it than the Neanderthals. And also, the other thing we seemed to learn how to do was cook meat. And so that killed so many of the parasites that it allowed our brains to grow. And as I write in the book too, and we partnered with dogs, domesticated wolves, so that, and there are a lot of anthropologists who think that one of the reasons our brains grew so much bigger than the Neanderthals is that we partnered with dogs. I mean, we domesticated wolves over a course of, you know, 10 or 20,000 years. And then they started guarding the human encampments so that humans could sleep for like 4, 5, 6 hours, which no other species was doing, because of course you had to be on guard all the time. I mean, I know you're a dog lover, like think of how lightly dogs sleep. You know what I mean? Like,
for sure.
They're until they get real old, but they're just awake at the drop of a needle and they're awake. You know, a car drives down our road and my dog wakes up. And humans sleep deeper and longer, maybe because dogs were guarding our ancestors' camps. So we have these certain things that happened in the history of our species that gave us these bigger brains. And frankly, hunting was a big part of that. And now it's just funny, these cultural and societal pressures to anthropomorphize animals and be like, well, but the deer has eyelashes. I could never kill a deer. You know, and that's kind of a arbitrary line to draw. If you're gonna like, oh, I'd eat a chicken or a fish, but I wouldn't eat a deer, or I wouldn't hunt a deer. So I tend to kind of bust people's chops on stuff like that and try to press them on it and ask their, you know, where did you come up with this kind of philosophy? Because we do tend to do that, and it's probably not the most healthy trait among humans to anthropomorphize other species. So I think we can probably try to, you know, disabuse ourselves of that.
For sure. And, you know, and in that same time, there's hunters aren't, you know, people who are advocating for abuse of animals either. Like, there's so much compassion towards egg farming with animals, and that they have, as much as a healthy, happy life as they can have as well. But in reality, you know, when you go out into nature and you see, in essence, how violent it really is and how nature really isn't kind. And yeah. I think part of witnessing that, in, if it's, you know, National Geographic TV shows on lions and how they live and things like that is really good for you to understand that we are still part of that circle. As much as we are advanced, we are still part of, you know, a circle of life amongst nature. And life isn't always going to be kind. And you have to learn how to survive and deal with it and not get triggered by every little thing that may happen. And I think when you understand how the natural world works, you understand that we are a part of that. And not everything in life is going to be kind to you. And it doesn't mean that you need to be hurt, but it's more of like just having an awareness of that life is gritty and it's hard. And actually, those things sometimes are really good for you.
Oh, yeah, totally. And there's a chapter in the book about the predator-prey relationship, and we're in it. You know, we're inextricably linked with other predators, with other predator species, and with other prey species, you know, and we're predators, we're not prey, but deer are prey, not predators. They're herbivores, we're carnivores. And, you know, at this kind of the anthropological and evolutionary thinking, is it's a lot harder being a predator than it is being prey, because there's fewer things to eat, and because the stuff you want to eat is running away from you, and the stuff a deer wants to eat is not running away from it, and the stuff a grouse wants to eat is not running away from it, but the stuff that a wolf wants to eat, or a coyote, or a human wants to eat, in the past at least, has been running away from it. So it takes a higher level of skill. And to be Darwinian about it, like the strongest survive, the most skilled Lori, your ancestors and my ancestors back 100,000 years were the most successful hunters, because they were the ones who survived long enough to procreate and generate another generation of Homo sapiens. And so I just, like, a big part of hunting for me is wanting to be more in touch with my ancestors and how I even got here. And not, I didn't get here because they could go into the grocery store and see 300 types of breakfast cereal and pick, you know. I got here because way back then, some of my ancestors were damn good hunters and were able to survive in a really, to use your term, a really gritty world. A world that did not have a lot of room for mistakes. You know, you made a mistake, you were dead. And so our ancestors, we made it here because they were the best of the best. And I want, I guess, in my hunting life, it's so different. You know, I've got a firearm that's very different than the primitive tools they were using. I'm wearing Thinsulate hat, a glove and gloves, and, you know, fancy hunting vests and stuff like that. So I'm not saying it's apples to apples by any means, but I think when I hunt, I want a little flavor of that, of what they did, a little taste of it. I want to feel a little bit linked to how they survived and what made them so successful. Because like you say, and as I make a point in the book, on the chapter on risk, we've really mitigated risk out of our daily lives. And that is, of course, a very understandable evolutionary trait for us. We want, you know, the less risk, the better off we are, and the more likely we are to live healthy, happy lives and to see more generations come and to not get sick and et cetera.
I love this chapter, by the way, the chapter.
Oh, thank you. But man, it's like we are here because of risk. We are here because our ancestors encountered and overcame extraordinary risks. Because, I mean, when Homo sapiens were going from whatever, four legs to two, we were not the apex predator. Like wolves, tigers, brown bears, there's a lot of animals that could still kill a human with very little effort. So we had to outsmart them, you know?
I totally agree with you. I personally believe there's a phrase that I love. It's like finding your edge. And what your edge is different to every person based on, you know, how far they want to take it. But there is a lot of science that goes back to when you spend time living at your edge. That for me, I'll give an example of what my one day of living on the edge for me is. My boyfriend Dan and I flew to Alaska and we spent the night and spent a full day hiking and exploring a glacier in Alaska. And the only way to get there was via helicopter. And we were dropped off on this glacier, just the two of us and a guide. And the helicopter took off. There was no cell service. And we were climbing crevasses that were jumping over crevasses that were hundreds and hundreds of feet deep. We were ice climbing and exploring all day long. Now, some of that was inherently risky. Now, if you are climbing down the side of a glacier, which is a massive ice wall, and your crampon, as you call it, the cramp, the claw things at the bottom of your feet slip, well, my face is going to go smacking dab right into the ice. If I'm jumping over a 100-foot crevasse and I fall down the crevasse, am I hooked up onto rope lines? Am I going to die? Probably not. Could I break an arm? Sure. So that day, you know, your adrenaline's a little high, and 8 hours of hiking flew by like an hour. And when you go to those places, that could either be, you know, a long hike, if it's running a marathon, if it's anything that gets you connected to something other than your cell phone and sitting in a chair, is really equated to a lot of happiness. And it's a great antidepressant. And the amount of people, and especially teens, due to technology and devices and social media, and how many are struggling with feelings of depression and not enoughness, and the comparative game of, you know, the highlight reel of social media. What taking risk can do for you is incredible. And so I feel like it's a need that everybody should go out and find their edge and discover that and play with it. And I think you see people really go to the edge, which would probably be like base jumping or skydiving and those types of things. That's their edges. But there is that moment where you go into this state of flow where you're not thinking about anything else. You're not thinking about bills to pay. You're not thinking about work. You're just right in that moment and you're 100% there and nothing else is going through your brain. And that is so good for you. So in your book, when you were saying that it's so important to expose kids to risk, I firmly believe it is so important to do that. And there's a lot of science too that say some of the happiest kids on our planet are farm kids that have to work every day, because it's also you're working towards something. Now, again, that's not necessarily risky, but I love that chapter in your book.
Hi, everybody. Ron Shera here again with another nifty story, this one about my favorite bank, the story of Star Bank. There's 10 of them in Minnesota. But here's where the plot thickens. A Star Bank is more than money. A Star Bank cares about its customers, cares about the community, whether it's town parades or the kids' baseball team. Why? Because Star Banks are locally owned. They treat you right. Quite a tale, wouldn't you say? How do I know? Because Star Bank is also our bank at Ron Shera Productions. Just another story with a happy ending. Star Bank, the bank that cares. Member FDIC. To learn more online, go to star.bank.
Got the winter blues? Start planning your summer. Plan on fun and get out in the water with your boat club. Your boat club offers boat club memberships and daily rentals with access to over 40 bodies of water and over 400 brand new boats to enjoy. Whether you want to cruise on a pontoon, create waves in a speedboat, or reel in a big one on a fishing boat, your boat club has got you covered. Unlimited boating memberships are available now, starting at just $1.99 a month after a one-time initiation. Life is better on the water. Find out more today at yourboatclub.com.
Our sponsor, Tito's Handmade Vodka, is America's original craft vodka, distilled from corn and naturally gluten-free. Over 25 years ago, the first batch of Tito's was made in the heart of Austin, Texas, and tomorrow's batch will be too. Tito's tastes just as good with tap water as it does with your favorite mixer. Tito's makes the good stuff for the good times, too. You can find recipes, videos, and more at titosvodka.com. True adventures are crafted together. And Tito's Handmade Vodka is also pledging to protect where we play by working with nonprofits to protect and enhance our national parks for the present and future generations to come. To learn more, visit titosenvironmental.com.
And you spoke something about availability bias. Do you want to share what that is with our listeners? Because I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. Availability bias. That's an interesting topic, or, you know, because it's the way that sociologists and anthropologists explain that we as humans, like, we get in airplanes to fly and we get in cars to drive. And some people are so afraid of flying that they won't fly because they're afraid they're going to die in a crash, a fiery crash. Even though statistics are clear that, like, we have a much greater chance of death driving a car, or, you know, dismemberment or whatever. Like, driving a car is way more dangerous than flying in an airplane. But because the visual image in our mind of dying in a plane crash is so much more vibrant and scary than dying in a car wreck. We have a human tendency to kind of ignore the reality and ignore the statistics and go with kind of I guess the availability is like what's forefront on our minds. So it probably, as I said in the book, you know, it probably served our ancestors really well, because, like, if you see somebody in your clan get eaten by a tiger, that's a pretty vibrant kind of experience. And then you're probably going to, like, be really wary of tigers and try to avoid them, you know? So it helped us until a certain point when it doesn't help us anymore, because we ignore the rational statistics. It's why we're, like, probably still afraid of spiders or snakes, even though, you know, like, here in Minnesota, we don't really have snakes that can kill you. So, availability bias is something we have to kind of fight when we're out in the wilderness, because, bad things can happen. But if we take, you know, if we take precautions, we can pretty much guard against a lot of that.
So true. Even 5 minutes of sunlight in your eyes every morning as the sun's coming up, or in the first part of daylight, is so beneficial for you. So instead of hopping on social media first thing in the morning or Twitter to read crazy headlines, I make it an effort to, I take my little dog Bacon out for a walk every morning. We do 1 mile religiously. And that's what I do. I get natural sunlight in my eyes. And, you know, there are certain mornings that might be cold, and sometimes they're too cold for the dog, but I'll still bundle up and get natural sunlight in my eyes. And there is something to be said about discipline. And, you know, not everybody is motivated every single day to get everything on their checklist done, but it requires discipline. And sometimes you just do the things that you don't necessarily always want to do. We have a cold plunge pool here at our house in Austin, and it's at 48 degrees. It's freezing. And that takes discipline. Do I want to get in it? Dan's better at it than I am. But, you know, it's not negotiating with yourself. And some of these things, such as planning those trips to, you know, a trail, and you might think it's stressful because how are you, you know, packing the kids' stuff and their food and the camping and all the stuff. It is challenging to get all the details done to get to the destination. But once you're there, you never say, man, I wish we wouldn't have done that. You always say, I'm so happy we did. And that, again, is that gift that I always say it's God's gift is nature and the outdoors, and what it does to literally lift your spirit and be able to accomplish life, because life is just inevitably, it's not always going to be, you know, rainbows and smiley faces. We're going to have hard times. I do want to, in the essence of time though, want to talk about the chapter about dogs, because I know you're a dog lover. So am I, and many of our listeners are as well. But the power of the companion of a dog. Why did you write that chapter?
Yeah, well, I wrote that chapter because I love dogs. I really love dogs. And because, well, as I explain in the book, in that chapter called Companions, as I was looking back on my adult life and what I went through, I realized that these three dogs, these three yellow labs, they each, the first two were with me for a decade each, and now Crosby, he's been with me for about half a decade. He's just about to turn six. And so I was like, oh, these dogs, like they represent chapters of my adult life. The first dog I got like right at the beginning of my first marriage. And that dog like walked with me through that first marriage. And in fact, as I write in one of the, I think, most heart-wrenching scenes in the book, probably, when I left that house and left that marriage, I didn't even have a duffel bag with clothes in it. Like, I had the clothes on my back when I walked out. But that dog, Beaumont, he walked out of that house with me. And he was so old and his hips had gone, you know, and I had to lift him into the truck to, you know, so he could be my companion as I drove away. And then he died. I mean, he died, like, as I say in the book, he died with that first marriage. He actually died like a month later. And then I was without a dog for maybe a year, and I had started dating Courtney, who's now my wife, and she lived in Dallas at the time, and I was broke, like completely broke, and had been foreclosed on and stuff like that. But I knew of a dog that was for sale that had been returned to the breeder in Menominee, Wisconsin. I think it was $425. He was like a year old. And Courtney sent me a check. I got a check in the mail from her from Dallas for $425. And she said, "You need a dog. Go buy that dog." So Albert really was like with me for the decade when I rebuilt my life, from age 40 to age 50. And in fact, during the time when Courtney moved up here and we got married, and I got custody of my kids, and then, you know, kind of my life had become much more settled and figured out. And then during COVID, right at the beginning of COVID, we used MinPets, shout out to MinPets, an at-home euthanasia service. And they came over, and Albert had lymphoma, and he was 10 and a half. He had a great, great life, a lot of hunting, a lot of love. And he, we put him down during March of 2020. And it was pretty, one beautiful blessing of that was that my two college kids had been sent home from college right there at the beginning of COVID, you know, so they were home and could be there with us in the backyard. And we had a puppy running around that backyard too, and that is Crosby. And he's on the cover of the book, and Crosby's my buddy now. So, you know, these companions in that chapter of the book are so important. It's really a great part of the Minnesota Bound TV story, because that was the focus of that TV piece. So I was very cool, I think, that Pete, the cameraman and editor of that piece, chose to kind of focus on the dog part. But you know, dogs have been our companions for, I don't know, I don't think anthropologists know exactly, but 10,000 years, more. You know, we over a period of many years, thousands of years, domesticated wolves, and they became dogs, and they became our companions. They are probably part of the reason we have the big brains that we do as Homo sapiens, is because domesticated wolves guarded our camps at night, the camps of our ancestors, allowing us to sleep longer and allowing our brains to develop and grow. And obviously dogs became our hunting companions. There's all sorts of archaeological evidence that dogs helped, you know, like round up herds, for instance, herds of bison, to run them off cliffs so that native people, you know, would kind of finish the job at the bottom of the cliff and butcher up the bison and share the meat with the dogs. So, yeah, dogs help us survive. I mean, my dogs helped me survive emotionally, and dogs helped my ancestors survive physically. So, it was kind of a no-brainer to devote an entire chapter to them.
Well, Tony, this was so fun to have you on the podcast. I feel like we could go on and on. We need to have a part two on more, because there's more chapters in your book, and I feel like we could have you back on.
Oh, well, Laura, I mean, thank you. It's a joy to be on this, and to have your dad do the voiceover of my story on Minnesota Bound, the TV show, it's like, it's every Minnesotan's dream. I mean, Ron Shera, the voice of Ron Shera, like forever voicing over a story about me on Minnesota Bound. Are you kidding me? Yeah, that's a dream come true. So I would come on anytime. I'd love to have you come on my podcast. I think let's keep this conversation going for sure. I really, really appreciate you having me on.
Oh my goodness. Well, you're doing God's work yourself by introducing others to the outdoors, and really with the release of this book and how you really can find yourself and your soul and all the things you need, and learning lessons are definitely just a step outside. That's for sure. If our listeners want to find you, I know you're on social media and you have your own podcast and a website. Where can our listeners find more information about you?
Well, thanks for asking. The easiest place is godofwildplaces.com. That will take you to my website. It has all the links to the different places to buy the book. If you want to buy one directly from me and have me sign it, or if you want to buy one as a gift and have me sign it and sign it to someone else, just go right there. Godofwildplaces.com is the place to go. Thanks.
Awesome. Tony Jones, the God of Wild Places, rediscovering the divine in the untamed outdoors. Thanks again, Tony. And also thanks to our sponsors, Kinetico, Oh, I cannot talk anymore. All right, 3, 2, 1. Thank you, Tony. And also thanks to our sponsors, Kinetico, Lakes Gas, Star Bank, Tito's, Minnesota Masonic Charities, and Your Boat Club. Remember, introduce a kid to the great outdoors.